Hey everyone, welcome to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have an amazing show for you today. This is episode 202 of the IoT podcast, and we're going to be talking about Lowe's Irish shutting down. We've got acquisitions galore to talk about. We're going to be talking about LifeX, Wigwag, and Neo. You may not know all of those companies, but you probably know their acquirers. And we have the New York Times did an editorial on consent. We're going to be talking about that as it relates to IoT devices, both here and in our guest. The EU is recalling children's smartwatches that leak location data. And the UK, which may not be part of the EU any longer, is spending £70 million on IoT security. Plus, got some new skills for the Google Assistant. We've got bad news for IoT security again. And we're going to hear from a new advertiser this week called Urban X. Plus, Denise Howell, who is an attorney in Newport Beach, California, came on the show to talk about all the crazy ramifications of having connected devices, especially in criminal and civil proceedings. You're going to want to hear this and understand what rights you have and most likely what rights you don't have. So let's get to it with a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Western Digital.
Western Digital builds data solutions that enable the world to solve its biggest challenges. On your phone, in your car, throughout your home, and across cities. Everywhere data lives, we're there to drive the innovation necessary for the best results today and tomorrow. From devices to systems and solutions, our end-to-end infrastructure creates the right conditions for data to realize its potential. Learn more at datamakespossible.com. That's datamakespossible.com.
Okay, Kevin. And before we get started on the show, I should tell everybody, I've had a couple emails lately of people trying to play our show on their Google Assistant or the Echo device. The reason you can't get it is because we are actually the Internet of Things podcast. So if you would like to hear it, you just have to say, Madam A, play the Internet of Things podcast. And that will actually work. I know, it's deceptive. Okay, let's talk about Lowe's Iris shutting down. Kevin, this makes me so sad. I remember all the way back in like 2012, getting excited about Lowe's Iris and getting my own and setting it up and being kind of miffed because it had a subscription fee to do a lot of the really cool stuff. This was in the era of Staples Connect and smart things launching. And I can't remember if Wink was on the scene yet or not, but
well, the good news is there's no subscription fee anymore.
Yes, there's no Iris. So at the end of last year, they said that they were looking for a buyer. At the time, I really doubted that they could find one because it's a weird platform. You'd have to support all the users. It's a dedicated system, so it's not, it didn't seem like something anyone else would be excited to own, basically.
Right. It's got to be a challenge to make money if you're a buyer of this to, you know, like you said, support people, turn a profit, and so on and so forth. And yeah, it's not like we didn't know this was coming, because as you said, and we said on the show a couple months ago, they're looking for a buyer. We get a lot of questions about Lowe's Iris, you know, is it still going to be viable, and so on and so forth. At this point, no. March 31st, it is shutting down the platform. But, you know, we see this happen all the time, probably less now as the market is maturing. But this is probably the best possible way something like this could shut down for its customers, because people can continue to use the service through March 31st. You're not going to be charged after January 31st. So, you know, you still get like 2 free months. And there are prorated refunds actually going out to customers, which I'm very surprised by.
Yeah, you're going to get, if you're a registered Iris user, you'll get this email. And if you click through on the link to the email, you can actually register for a prepaid Visa card. So you're going to get a Visa card for, and I guess in one of the articles, someone who had Iris said that they got about $100 for their hub and $140 for their video camera, which was about what he paid for it.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, as these shutdowns go, it's a pretty rapid shutdown. Usually you get a little longer lead time sometimes, but you don't get rebates. Remember when Nest bought Revolve and they were just like, We're going to shut this down in 6 months. And everyone was like, what? I paid $300 for this thing. And then finally, Nest had to come back and offer some rebates. So it's sad. Lowe's is doing well by its users by doing this. And as a bigger picture, let's talk about what this means for the smart home. Because while Lowe's is doing this, IKEA is actually doubling down with more products and their CEO getting up on stage and talking about like launching, oh, we're going to have a kitchen as a service. We're going to have, you know, furniture as a service in this kind of rent, not to own, just rent to rent concept in products because of the connectivity being able to enable it. So I find it interesting that Lowe's is like, no. IKEA is like, yeah.
Well, I'm surprised that IKEA, in a sense, is going after this space, but they are different from Lowe's because they are selling furniture. They are selling the insides of your home, whereas Lowe's sells the components for the inside of your home, building materials and so on. Yes, they do sell appliances and other things, but it is a different type of store. So I see this as a better fit for IKEA. I'm not saying they're going to be successful. I certainly hope they are, but I mean, based on the data that they have, they must assume they could be successful here. And I could see why they may think that. We'll have to see if that's the actual reality, though.
Yes. And I will also say, I talked to some of the people who participated in Lowe's Iris over the years. And one of the complaints they had was that companies would add connectivity to their products for the Lowe's Iris system, but they wouldn't do it in a thoughtful way. And what happened was they were doing it primarily to get promotion at Lowe's, to get the...
Yes.
The branding. So customers didn't always have an awesome experience, or sometimes the connectivity didn't enable anything that made sense. And that's unfortunate. So
it is. It is.
We'll see. I mean, yeah. I still go to, you know, my hardware. I was at Lowe's the other day buying more smart lights. So I'm like, oh.
Yeah, they'll continue to sell smart home devices. It's just, you know, the Iris brand and service is going away. If you do want to get that redemption, don't go to your store for that. It's all done online. However, Lowe's does say in the letter that they sent out to people that you can return any Iris items purchased within the last 90 days that are not connected to the Iris platform via the normal return policy. So you may be able to get money back that way as well.
Yeah, if you thought, oh, I'll buy this now and then maybe later I'll put it on the platform. All right, so sad news there, but maybe not unexpected. This feels like we're... As the market's maturing, we're seeing a closing down of kind of the early days. And speaking of that, we've got a bunch of acquisitions. So let's start with LifeX. LifeX was just acquired by Buddy Home, which is based in Australia. LifeX was actually created in Australia. We had the founders on the podcast like in 2014 or some crazy thing. And, you know, typical thing, wanted colored light bulbs. They've come a long way. They did a deal with Qualcomm, licensing IP thing for Wi-Fi chips for light bulbs, basically. And now they're bought by Buddy, which is an IoT platform in Australia that does energy monitoring and management, which is not something I actually associate with LifeX at all.
And neither do I. And that's the funny thing. The intent is to use the LifeX products to gain more energy monitoring data, but did you have to buy LifeX for that? I kind of scratched my head over that.
This may be a forced acquisition. I mean, if you look at where we are in the market, we're seeing a lot of companies, they're like, oh, it's time. You got to reach scale or you got to go.
True. So the purchase price is $51 million.
Yeah. I feel like LifeX probably, if they were amazing, would do better than that. But they actually are the number two vendor in the, is it the colored smart light bulb space?
In smart bulbs is what they say, behind Philips, which is no longer really Philips.
Well, it is Philips Hue, but the company that actually owns the Philips Hue light bulbs is called Signify, just in case you guys were not confused enough. So now, do we know if we're going to see, you know, LifeX products continuing to be for sale here in the States?
I would expect so, even though Buddy is mainly an Australia-based platform. I mean, I think that would be kind of silly to spend $51 million and then really limit your sales.
Yeah.
They haven't really said, but I can't imagine that LifeX goes away from everywhere but Australia.
In the meantime, we've got another acquisition, and things will go away. Wigwag, which is a sensor company based in Austin. They started out making a very generic sensor and then pivoted to making an industrial or an enterprise IoT platform. They have been acquired by Arm, the chip design firm. This looks like a straight up It feels like, because Arm has such a big presence in Austin, it feels like somebody's friend was like, yeah, sure, we'll buy your company. I'm sure there's like some intellectual property happening here, but Wigwag, their platform will be closing on May 6, 2019. And Arm did send some refunds to the backers of the Wigwag Kickstarter from way back in the day. So
I missed that Kickstarter.
You did? So I remember it really well because we were at GigaOM and we were in the middle of a cloud conference. And when they launched their Kickstarter, it was awesome. It was like this generic sensor that was going to do everything. And I mean, I wanted it like right then and there. And it was in like 2013 that that happened. It was the sort of thing that I guess when we thought the home automation market would be more creative and fun, like you could actually like create all these cool rules and I thought people would want to, but they really didn't. It had a humidity, vibration, temperature, all this stuff. And I thought, you know, it's a great thing that you could put it like on your washing machine. And when it stopped moving, it'd be like, oh, your washing's done. And it was basically a platform for that. And then later on, they pivoted to be more enterprise focused and create a gateway device and then sensors there. But that did not work either. So goodbye, Wigwag. Hopefully ARM is taking maybe some of your interface. I don't know really what ARM
what they're getting,
this.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a people deal. There was no pricing associated with this. Okay. And then finally, Control 4, which is a professional home automation system.
Charlie Kendall's company.
Yeah, Charlie Kendall's there. It's not his company, but he's there. Charlie Kendall, the former head of Amazon smart home stuff for Madam A, he went over there last year. So they bought a company called Neo.
And the Matrix.
Not the Matrix, but this is a very cool futuristic looking device that controlled your television. It controlled your lights. It worked and it was really beautiful. I think it launched at a CEDIA event, but maybe it was CES. I've seen it for the last couple of years at those shows. And it's fancy. It's nice.
It's pretty. I mean, it's got a display on it and very simple buttons. And it's tapped into their database of like a gazillion products. I think it's 60,000 devices.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And basically, when I talked to Charlie briefly about this deal, this is their whole thing is that the smart home is too complex for like DIYers. Most people are not going to want to integrate all this together. So they're trying to bring in pieces that they think are attractive and useful and easy to use. So their dealer network can come in and do it for people. And then people still have like more options to control stuff. So that's the deal here.
Yeah, but the interesting thing, current Neo customers, they're going to get support for all services up for another 24 months. They're not going to sell the Neo anymore.
Yeah.
So
it's a soft, I mean,
they're not buying it for the remote. They're buying it, I guess, for the smarts, the SDK, the database.
And the design sensibility, I believe. They're very hyped up about that. Okay. So all of these acquisitions, big picture, you guys, we talked about this. We've talked about this for the last year and a half. There are a lot of IoT platform plays that got funded in 2013, 2014. They're all going away. They couldn't reach scale, and thus they're going away.
Yeah, and getting subsumed. I mean, it's not like they had bad technology, et cetera, but they can't do it alone, obviously.
Right. And I mean, that's not surprising. A lot of these companies got a lot of their money and started right after Google paid $3.2 billion for Nest, which was at a crazy rate. And everyone was like, oh my God, I got to get in on this smart home thing. And that was the high right there.
Yep. And it was way high. I still don't think it was the best purchase price value.
No, not the best use of their money. But, you know, Nest is still around, still doing well. They're integrating it better into things. I think they're making lemonade out of their lemons, as it were. Mm-hmm. So go Google. Okay, let's talk about privacy and data security and all that good stuff that we love so much here at the show. This weekend, the New York Times did an article on consent and the practice of doing these long EULAs and you basically saying, yeah, I agree. And thinking that's a reasonable way to do a contract between a user and a data company.
And they are longer than I thought. I always thought the EULAs were long, but it was interesting to see right in the beginning of the story, reading Amazon's terms and conditions alone out loud takes approximately 9 hours.
Yes.
Yowza.
Yes. I mean, maybe if you read it to yourself, it takes less, but it is a long time. And I'll tell you, I read all of these.
That's like a whole day's worth of effort.
Yeah. And I mean, when you read them, there's only one option. You click yes if you want to use it. If you click no, This you whole can't. World is closed to you. So it feels like it is a very uneven exchange, basically. Especially, you know, in my opinion, when I'm like, I've already paid you money to buy this device and the functionality associated with it.
And you're paying that money before you even know what the terms of service are.
Exactly. So there have been some ideas here. We've talked to people on the show who suggested, like, when you put a device in your Amazon cart, you get a little kind of like, you know, Apple or Google does with their, you know, permissions when you download an app. You get something like that that says, this shares data with third parties. Do you consent to this? Do you consent to that? And then you have to read those before you can actually buy the product, which I think is not a bad idea. I still think
it's a very good start.
I don't know if we're ever going to see that. But so that's one way to do that. So the New York Times essay, I bring this up because this is something we've talked about for like 2 or 3 years. I mean, we've talked about the lack of any meaningful consent when you sign these things and the lack of recourse for consumers when they realize what they've given up. You can't always bring things back without paying like a restocking fee or, you know, sometimes you just can't bring it back at all. And that feels unfair. And I'm glad the New York Times is talking about this because the New York Times is, as it were, the paper of record. So when they start talking about things, things actually happen, which, you know, I wish we had that power, Kevin, but we do not.
We do not, but they did point out some of the things we have talked about before. Obviously, GDPR over in the EU and then the California law.
Yes, this is definitely something that people are thinking more about with, you know, the wide array of Facebook scandals, some of the privacy conversations that Apple's trying to bring up, and of course, GDPR. So the solution here, I don't know. There's efforts by, like I told you about that particular idea about looking at data before you put something in your cart. There's also Public Knowledge released a paper last week about creating a security shield. This is more about security and not as much about privacy. But the idea is they're encouraging the government to create a program called the Security Shield that is kind of like the EPA's Energy Star program. And so if you're not familiar with it, the Energy Star program is federally, there's a law written that talks about what standards things need to meet to achieve this sticker, basically. And Public Knowledge's paper is all about how to create such a program for IoT device security. So that would be useful, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So yes, maybe that will happen. I'm sure it'll be incredibly watered down, but let's talk about let's talk about another security challenge. This is actually in the EU, home of GDPR. So there is a recall of children's smartwatches that are leaking location data, which nobody wants.
No. This is the Safe Kid 1 made by a German company called Enox Group. It is not for sale in the UK or the US, but apparently in Iceland, they found out that the mobile app that works with the watch has unencrypted communications to the servers, so there is unauthenticated access to the data, so you could get the location history of a child wearing this watch, phone number, serial number, etc. Yeah, so it was basically, I think they call it a rapid alert as part of the rules and laws over there to recall this thing, and that's actually what's happening.
That's pretty powerful. Forcing a product recall is, that's not a thing to be taken lightly.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't want to say this is overkill. This is okay. This is a problem. It needs to be resolved. But I mean, if it's just the mobile app that has the unencrypted data, why couldn't they just put an app update out that encrypts that data?
Probably because they couldn't ensure, one, because it's the EU. But two, maybe they couldn't ensure people downloaded the patch. Maybe the watch was too small. The hardware on the inside was too small to like take the patch and then reboot. I don't know.
Yeah, but from a technical standpoint, if it's connecting to a backend server and it's the data going to that server, they could shut the service off until people updated. And it's not the watch that gets updated. It's actually the app, according to the story. So maybe it's just to send a message. I don't know. Like, we're not going to tolerate this kind of, you know,
we're not going to take it. No. All right. Oh, I'm singing. It must be a good day. Speaking of encryption, and let's take a moment to say, here's the basic rule. You should encrypt your data on your servers. You should encrypt your data behind the app. And you should encrypt the data on the device. And then
yes,
whenever that data is traveling between the app and the device, between the app and the cloud, the phone and the cloud, you should also encrypt there. That should just be the way it is. And yes, encryption is a pain. There's a little bit of overhead. There's some costs associated with it. But if you want a secure IoT, it's not job one. Not having hard-coded passwords is surprisingly job one.
Yeah.
But that's part
of the
job. It's
still table stakes. It's still table stakes. Absolutely.
So this brings us to a report about a lack of encryption on some popular IoT devices. Kevin?
Yeah, this is a test data from researchers at Brazil's Federal University of Pernambuco, which I may have totally screwed that up, but that's okay. And the University of Michigan, which I got that right. They took close look at
Go Wolverines.
Oh, go Wolverines. Yes. Oh, Tom Brady's alma mater, whatever. The report took a look at 32 smartphone apps used to configure and control 96 of the top-selling Wi-Fi and Bluetooth devices sold on Amazon. So that's a pretty good test bed, I think. Unfortunately, they found out that 31% of the apps had no encryption at all, and another 19% had hard-coded encryption keys, so you could perhaps reverse engineer the encryption. Bad, bad, bad. If you're going to do it right, folks. Specifically, this kind of jumped out at me because of the companies and products named here. They created some proof of concept attacks based on their findings, and they basically were able to hack around with TP-Link's Casa app, the LifeX app, Belkin's Wemo, and Broadlink's eControl app. So granted, a lot of these hacks, you'd have to be on the same Wi-Fi network and so on. That's kind of a given in many cases, but that doesn't make it acceptable. So that's a problem.
And they also shared that TP-Link, they have the same hard-coded encryption key for all of the devices of a given product line.
Yeah, yeah. They even showed the code. I mean, I can see the Java code, and I actually can understand it thanks to my Java class. They have the seeding number for the hashing and encryption, and I could probably figure out what the encryption key is based on that. Well, actually, so could probably anybody with the time and effort.
Yeah, and Kevin hasn't spent that much time and effort, I'll tell you. So, This is not, on that. So this is not that hard. So what does this mean for you guys, people who have these devices? I have TP-Link switches in my house. I have Wemo. I used to have a Wemo light. Actually, this month we're giving away a Wemo dimmer switch.
Encryption not included.
So in some cases, it's a design decision. So Wemo doesn't do encryption. They don't do encryption between the device and the app as part of making it easier for users, they say. Now, I know one of their former security folks has, you know, they left over this. So this is something that they've chosen to do, even though they know that it's this way. So you might say, okay, we talked about risk profiles in previous podcasts, but you might say, hey, do I have a high enough risk profile that I should really worry about this? Or are the devices that are plugged into these outlets going to really cause problems? You know, is it an air purifier or is it a curling iron?
A thermostat. I mean, I don't know. Well, you wouldn't plug that in, obviously, but I'm just thinking.
A weed whacker, a blender?
A portable heater.
Oh, there you go. A space heater. That's perfect.
Yes.
So, you know, think about what you've got plugged into these devices, who might want to hack you, how easy it is. Getting on your Wi-Fi network is not super trivial unless you hand out your Wi-Fi network like candy, which some people do. I always recommend guest network for everybody, especially your kids' friends. Man, today is just chock full of security tips from us.
Yeah, I would also recommend choosing devices where the apps have two-factor authentication to log into those apps. That way, people cannot log into an app as you, easily anyway, and control your devices if they were to gain access to those devices.
Yeah, for example, if I was on Kevin's Wi-Fi network and he had Wemo devices, because I have Wemo devices in my house and I'm running the app already, I could just open my Wemo app in his house if I'm on his network and start controlling his devices.
Yeah, that would be bad.
And Wemo knows that. That's not something.
No, it's a design choice. I understand. So on the flip side, the report, it's not all doom and gloom. The report did point out that Google's Nest Thermostat app is a good example of how to do security right, which I know that also supports two-factor authentication. And all the configuration is secure with SSL TLS to the cloud or via Wi-Fi with WPA. So there are right ways to do that. There are examples of this, and it kind of should be a standard, but that's a whole other issue that we sort of touched upon earlier.
Yeah, in Google, I will say Google does a lot of stuff behind the scenes on the security front as well. I'm not allowed to talk about some of the things they do, but they're very good. The Nest devices are very good. I feel very comfortable. When they see flaws or when people bring things up, they actually communicate with users, they update. TP-Link has had a couple hacks and they have not updated a lot of stuff. So They're cheap, though, and that's what people seem to be buying. So it's that's the downside or the flip of this, is that security does cost money and it costs convenience. And people, I don't know. I don't actually have two-factor enabled on my Nest, even though I think it's a great thing to have.
Oh, no, any chance I can, I do. And I have a Google Titan security key for all those accounts. You can use an authenticator app. There are lots of ways to do it. You can use SMS messaging, which would be my least favorite option. That's not as secure as other options. So, yeah.
All right. Well, see, now we know that I am terrible and Kevin is good. And oh, I should add that the Chamberlain MyQ also has two-factor authentication, which this is the year of us calling for two-factor on all IoT devices. So get used to it. Yeah.
You're not using it. Maybe I should come to your house and try and control your Nest.
And it's time for me to enable two-factor.
Yep.
Getting right on that. Okay. Speaking of Google, we've got some news on Assistant. Google Assistant can now be your interpreter, which they announced at CES. I was super excited about it. And then I had, like, right when I got home from CES, I had a foreign exchange student in my house from Spain. And we totally could have used it, but it wasn't out yet. And now it is. So what is it?
Yeah, it is. I was at the CES demo that Google gave, and it worked flawlessly in that demo. I mean, and it wasn't canned or staged. It was just a regular Google Home device, and they had a whole conversation in English and French. It does, obviously, multiple languages, but they showed it off. It was cool. It's one of those cool features that, I'll never use because I don't really have foreign exchange students here, but it is rolling out now. So if you have need of it, you should see it anytime soon, I would say.
And what do you say?
If you want to have a conversation in any language, let's say Spanish, you say, be my Spanish interpreter or help me speak Spanish. And it becomes almost a port of the Google Translate mobile app right on, like, if you have a smart home display, it'll show both sides of the conversation in the two languages. So you can read it as well as hear it. But if you don't, it would just, if you have a Google Home, you would just hear the translation, not see it. But again, it seemed to work very well.
Yay. And I actually, so not in person, but in communicating via, email and text with the parents of our exchange student, I would actually use the translate function on Google Assistant. I'd be like, I type my thing in English and it would translate it to Spanish. Then I'd cut and paste it in there. And apparently they got the gist. So we're good.
You didn't use those Google Pixel Buds? You would probably return those, didn't
you? I returned those like the second I put them in my ears.
Yeah, those were those really nifty, at least in theory, headphones that you would connect to your phone and it would use the Google Translate app kind of in real time so you could hear the translations and so on. But it didn't seem to work very well.
The headsets, they were not good. So other Google news, making life a little easier. Now you can get Google Assistant on your Nest Guard. And if you're like, what is my Nest Guard? It is part of the Nest security system. It is the brains of that. It's a little hub thing that you can wave your tag over to turn your alarm on and off. And basically now you can ask it things like, oh, hey, G, do I need an umbrella today? And it will help you.
Yeah, this is rather sneaky because I don't know that everybody knew there was a microphone in that.
Yeah, so it's an opt-in feature, and it's opt-in because the Nest Guard does have an on-device microphone. If you've got one and you're like, no, it's not enabled by default. So that's why you've got to opt in here. But
right, it's not an always-listening device if you don't want it to be.
What I would love, and I don't know if it works this way, but because you're doing this as you rush out the door, it would be awesome to set reminders for your Nest Guard to be like, do you have your gym clothes? It's Thursday, right? Or whatever, like, reminders you need as you walk out the door. Because I'm always walking out the door and forgetting things, right? So when you swipe that tag and it knows you're there, it'd be awesome if it just shouted out proactively, don't forget your gym clothes.
Yeah, I don't think it does that natively, which it would be really cool. I wonder if there's a routine available for that or someone whips one up.
Yeah. Well, and maybe, I mean, it's software. We can always make it better.
Yep.
So instead of just always asking, I'd have it proactively remind me about things that are important.
Right.
So, cool. All right. So that doesn't quite make for the, it's a very expensive security system, but it might be worth it eventually. That is it for the news section of the show. Let's go to the IoT podcast hotline. We've got a winner to announce and we have a question about light pads. This week, the IoT podcast hotline is sponsored by Affero. With the fifth largest IoT patent portfolio in the world, Affero provides a proven IoT platform that doesn't risk your brand. Affero customers have experienced as much as an 80% reduction in time to market and 10x higher activation rates. Learn more at affero.io. All right, on the voicemail this week, let's see, who was our winner for the January challenge? They will get my old Google Home.
Yay, that would be Martin, who called in last month for the January giveaway. So congratulations to Martin.
Woohoo! And if you want to be entered to win a Wemo dimmer switch, note all the security things we talked about, please give us a call at 512-623-7424. And you will be entered to win. That needs to happen before the end of February. It's a short month, so February 28th at midnight Eastern. You call us, and poof, it's magic. You're entered. So let's go to this week's voicemail, which is about, light switches. Yay!
Hey, Stacy, this is Ed from Louisville, Kentucky. My IoT question involves lighting. I currently have Plum light pads. I was part of their Kickstarter and purchased those. Seems that those are not viable anymore, at least from what I can gather through my internet search, and they're not working as well. The timing piece of it, because I use them on outside lights, actually is not working consistently enough for me, and so I'm looking for a smart light switch to implement in its place, because I love the color ring around the Plum light pad, but, you know, it's not a necessity. I've looked at the Noon light switches as well, but just looking for other options out there. Maybe CES 2019 will have some interesting stuff on that front as well.
Oh, Ed, this is sad news. This is another one of those companies that we thought might get bought, but didn't. Plum is actually an Austin company. It was founded by the former head of Cedia way back in 2012. And the idea was to make an awesome light switch that controlled everything. I mean, truly, it was way ahead of its time and it was very pretty. But they are no longer, it doesn't seem that they're operating anymore. I have not gotten any emails back from them about my questions and feels pretty grim. So the Plum light pads they're actually ahead of their time, but now we've got tons of options to choose from. You mentioned energy monitoring, and so that's throwing us for a little bit of a loop because the only energy monitoring light switch that we could find that was an actual switch was a Zigbee-based one from GE. If energy monitoring is important to you, then that's probably what you should go with, but then you've got hubs and all this other stuff. But if you just want a really highly functional advanced light pad, then we've got lots of options. You mentioned the Noon. Those are cool because they do these pre-designed lighting things and make it very pretty. I would also make a plug for Brilliance light pads. Those do a lot of home automation control and they don't have a pretty LED, but you can put your own photos on there. And that's kind of neat if you like to see pictures of your family or your favorite vacation spot on your light pad. They do have timer functionalities, alarms. They let you control your Sonos, your Nest, your all kinds of stuff. They're a little complicated to set up. I would recommend a professional install on those, and they're expensive, but they do a lot. If you're less, like you're like, oh, that is too much, iDevices makes a dimmer switch or a on-off switch. Usually you need to double check which is which. It only works with iOS, so only Apple, but it is Wi-Fi, so you don't need any sort of hubby type things. And they have that LED, they have an LED on the device that might be exciting. Or you can wait because you are entered to win our Wemo dimmer and you can see how you feel about that.
Yeah, we looked high and low for something very similar to the Plum, which is unique because it has an LED light ring around the switch. So sure, I mean, in the dark, it's real easy to find, but nobody else has done that we could see. There are plenty of switches that have like a little LED indicator, maybe an LED strip, but nothing around the entire paddle switch itself, unfortunately.
But there are lots of light switches. So if you want to, like I said, Brilliant Switch, I just wrote about a company called Oro. The Oro switch looks really interesting. I haven't tested it out and it feels like something you'd want to test. That's all about like wellness and circadian rhythms and dimming lights and automation, actually automatic automation, where it learns.
Lots of sensors in that one.
Yeah, tons of sensors in there. It doesn't do the energy monitoring. So I hate to, I'm not leaving you empty handed. I'm almost leaving you with too many things in your hands, but maybe you can call us back and let us know what your most important features are, because it's a little unclear. And I think in lighting today, you're going to have to decide like your top two features. It's kind of like buying a new car, right? You're like, I must have this and this. And then that's going to help you choose which cars to even look at. So, all right, that is it for this segment of the Internet of Things podcast. Stay tuned for our guest, Denise Howell. She is a lawyer. We're going to actually be talking about GDPR, what kind of data can be subpoenaed in a case from your smart devices. We're going to be talking about actually some of the consumer rights stuff about returning connected devices and consent. So it's a really good interview. You're going to love it. Stay tuned for that. And now let's go to a message from our sponsor. Hey everyone, we are taking a break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is UrbanX, and I have Micah Koch, who is Managing Director of UrbanX, here to talk to us. Hi Micah, how are you doing today?
I'm excellent, Stacey. Thanks for having us.
Excellent. So let's just get started with having you tell me a little bit about UrbanX.
UrbanX is an accelerator for startups who are reimagining city life. The program was built by many, and we run it in partnership with a venture fund called Urban Us. Our goal is to work with early stage technology companies, many of whom are working in the Internet of Things, and help them level up.
What resources do companies have access to during the program?
So our companies participate in a really immersive and intensive 5-month program to help accelerate their development from a product perspective, from a business perspective, and then really prepare them for fundraising. They get access to an incredible network of over 2,000 experts and entrepreneurs who serve as mentors and help guide them on their journey. We also help to provide them with 1,000 hours of hands-on resources in electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, UX, UI, graphic design, software development. We invest $100,000 in each of the companies that we work with on flexible terms. But fundamentally, we want to help really change their trajectory in a very short amount of time.
And what is the relationship between UrbanX and BMW/Mini?
This is a really great question. Our core business, obviously, at Mini is focused on offering products and services for mobility, but really the future of the brand is going to extend more deeply into other areas, including lifestyle components. And so when you think about the evolution in the automotive space and you look at autonomous, connected, electric, and shared services, we're really trying to identify new ways that we can kind of serve urban residents, which is where most of Mini's customers are. And people who are ultimately looking for new solutions, even when they're not within their vehicle.
And why is Mini, as a car brand, interested in improving life in cities?
Mini really has always been a quintessentially urban brand since it was created during the first gasoline crisis in the late 1950s. And I think the company really believes that it's vital that we engage and collaborate with people who are living in and experiencing cities and who are helping to define the future of cities so that we can create solutions to issues that matter the most and ultimately so that we can help bring those solutions to scale.
Where can people go if they want to find out more about UrbanX or even apply for your new cohort that starts in June?
So applications are due April 1st of 2019, and you can apply or nominate your favorite startup at urban-x.com/apply.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Denise Howell, who is a technology lawyer from Newport Beach, California. She is also a host and contributor at Twit. I too am a host at Twit. So hi, Denise, how are you?
Hi, Stacey. It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
I am super excited to have you because I love having lawyers on the show as long as they're willing to go out on a little bit of a limb and talk about things. Sometimes lawyers, they don't like to do that.
Well, I'll do my best.
There we go. I won't make you say anything too crazy, but there are tons of legal issues associated with the Internet of Things, most of which I think we're just going to have to find out by like suing people and watching the courts. So we're going to tackle it first with what everybody is talking about, which is privacy, data protection and privacy. And I feel like we're going to get some sort of law this year at a federal level. California just passed a law last year that goes into effect in 2020. What do you see ahead for privacy regulations in the U.S.?
I think I'm less optimistic than you are that we're going to get something at the federal level this year. I feel like our federal lawmakers have lots and lots on their mind. They've had a bill that they could have passed that's been sitting in committee for a while that regulated Internet of Things devices that are sold to the federal government. That hasn't passed yet. That's been sitting around for a bit.
That was kind of a lame law, though.
That was, I read that law and I was like, wow, that is like the bare minimum.
Right. Well,
hello, government.
I think you put your finger on the other problem, right? They don't necessarily know or have their arms around what they need to do more than the bare minimum. So for this issue to be legislated on a national level, I do think that will eventually happen. But I think what we will probably see on the Internet of Things front is what I think we'll also see on the privacy front is the states start to enact their own laws because their citizens are fed up and pressuring their local lawmakers to put something in place at the state level. And we start to get this patchwork of different regs in different places that, as a practical matter, everyone has to comply with if they're doing business in all of the states of the United States.
So most of the laws so far have dealt with the physical security of devices. So we're talking about things like, hey, let's not have hard-coded passwords. Let's make sure you force people to change your passwords. It's very much kind of good behavior and at a device level. In contrast, what's happened with Europe with GDPR is they actually did legislation that protected data. And I think those are kind of worth breaking apart just a little bit because obviously one is about security, but that's also about protecting people's data because insecure devices leech your data like crazy. How do you think legislators should define the problem of privacy and security with IoT devices?
Well, I think the regulators in the EU have swept IoT devices in right along with anything else. They haven't made their GDPR law device specific. So if you're breaching their law and if you are violating any of its tenets with any of your devices in how you're handling data, then you can be brought before one of their tribunals and fined quite a bit. That's one approach that we could see US lawmakers take. The Internet of Things has its own specific problems that I think, as you alluded to, states like California and others are trying to make sure that glaring problems like hard-coded passwords, et cetera, are dealt with. But just because there are specific laws directed at the Internet of Things doesn't mean that those devices won't also have to comply with data laws or the people putting those devices out there and then managing the data that they collect with them.
Okay, so we probably should see or could see both data privacy laws and then IoT specific, like, gosh, guys, secure your devices, lock them down.
Yes, I think that's very likely. The makers of these devices are going to have to deal with both kinds of laws.
So you're not as optimistic as I am about a federal law. I feel like the industry, the tech industry, is actually calling for this now because they're like, oh gosh, we're going to have so many different laws to deal with. Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, was talking at Davos last month about having some sort of global privacy and data regulation laws. Do you think that's crazy?
I don't think it's crazy at all. I'd love to see us move in that direction. It may be logistically difficult to get a cord that leads to a law that people can actually enforce and understand. But in concept, I think, you know, just like it's better to have a federal law that people can comply with and understand and not have to worry about whether things are different in Arkansas than they are in Missouri, it would be nice for all concerned to have adequate consumer protection, privacy and data protection on the one hand, and rules that are easy to interpret and follow for the manufacturers of these devices on the other. So I think that Satya Nadella's idea is a good one. And if he can get people talking about how to bring the logistics of it about, that's a positive step.
Let's talk about consumer rights with connected gadgets. So right now, we're just kind of figuring things out. And a lot of times what happens is I might buy a gadget or a device or a car, or in some cases, even, you know, a house. And it will come with a lot of home automation or smart stuff built in. The challenge is a lot of times you don't have the chance to read the terms of service until you're actually making this purchase or until you're actually, you know, you've bought it, you've downloaded the app, and now you're agreeing to everything. So to me, this seems like a terrible way to do things, especially when you're pulling so much data out of it. How might we change that?
It is a terrible way to do things. And that is one of the problems that the GDPR tries to address, that instead of just assuming that people have read and understood things, that at each interaction where data is going to be collected, a separate consent is required and things aren't just swept together in fine print that then is assumed to be and applied as binding. That's sort of the place where we would want to get to, but we're not there here in the United States. So as you point out, as far as these smart home devices go, it is the wild, wild west. And we're going to see a lot of litigation. We're going to see other laws that haven't been enacted specifically to deal with these problems being brought into play and applied. And in some cases, we have a legal framework in place. You know, we have tort law, which is if you recklessly harm somebody in a way that is protected under the law, then you can be sued. So it's a big, broad body of law. It's the body of law that deals with personal injuries. It also deals with things like less tangible harms. So you can harm someone's economic interests. You can harm someone's privacy interests. You can harm them emotionally. And so there are all kinds of torts out there that could be brought to bear on the Internet of Things. And I expect that if companies are reckless and misusing data and find themselves in a PR boiling kettle of fish, you're going to see a lot of already existing principles of tort law thrown at that and may start to rein some of this in.
And a lot of times these aren't terrible. Like one of the things I think is really difficult is it's very hard to prove the harms of having your data stolen, for example. Mm-hmm. Or I guess I could say, oh my gosh, you know, someone broke into my security camera and took naked pictures of me all over the internet. You know, that feels like I could prove harm there, I'm hoping. Because isn't that one of the core tenets of these sorts of lawsuits?
Sure. We have a right of privacy in this country. And if you've enabled someone to violate that right, then you would be held accountable under those kinds of principles. On the data front, I think proving harm comes down to, you know, if someone has stolen your identity, stolen your money, damaged your reputation, there are all kinds of ways of demonstrating and legal frameworks in place that prevent people willy-nilly being able to carry out those harms against you. So I think that the legal system and the laws that we have on the books, to some extent, are equipped to handle this explosion of devices and data, but it sure would be nice to have some thought given and analysis given and some laws drafted that actually address squarely and head on the problems that these devices present that might not be easily dealt with under the laws we already have.
Sure. I'm thinking of things like, let's say I have a corporate wellness program and my manager somehow gets data about my sleep patterns under this. This is not happening today, but we're not too far off given how some of the insurance companies are treating data from Fitbits and other medical devices. But let's say they're looking at that and they start to make decisions about like, oh, hey, maybe you should handle this account because, you know, it looks like you didn't sleep well last night and this is pretty easy. Let's send this guy in for this presentation. He's looking like he's slept more. He's more capable at the moment. Those kind of things feel more insidious than maybe just, you know, crashing your car into something. And that's where I think it becomes really challenging because these are also harms that could follow you throughout your life in a way that you may not even be aware of.
Right. I love your example there. Yeah, that's exactly the kind of situation where you may not even know that decisions are being made about you based on data that people shouldn't have. Maybe accidentally you would find that out, but then how could you address it? That's a really tough one. And I agree, that's some gray area that we're getting into.
Okay. And this idea of maybe unknown harms, there's also some very clear harms that I don't think we think about when we buy these connected devices, which is that they could be used against us in a court of law, be it a civil court or I'm not planning on murdering anyone, but you know, maybe something would happen. And then I have all of these cameras, microphones, I have all of this data in my house that's being collected. And I'm very curious, how do you think that situation is going to evolve?
Well, it's already evolving. We've seen instances already where prosecutors in murder actions and investigations have obtained data from relevant people's Fitbits and Echoes. And there was a case we talked about a few times on This Week in Law that involved a murder in Arkansas, where it was actually a connected device on the water heater for the home.
Yes, the hot tub murders.
This one?
Yes. And they actually tracked the water usage at like 2 a.m. and decided that meant this person was cleaning up.
Right. strange, strange things already going on as far as prosecutors getting creative in how they're going to build their case. So, of course, that's a boon for law enforcement that they have all this data to pick and choose from in trying to prove a case. It's not necessarily a boon for all the litigants, because although you're not planning to commit murder, maybe you still wouldn't be planning to commit murder when one was committed. And somehow you wind up in the crosshairs of a prosecution because of the data that seems to point to you.
Sure. I might be at the wrong place at the wrong time, jogging through a crime scene with my heart rate going.
Right. Exactly. So we're definitely seeing those kinds of things start to unfold already, and it will only get worse. I mean, I imagine people wrung their hands in this way and speculated in this way when everyone began to have a computer where they were storing a lot of information. And certainly smartphones have been a huge part of the data environment for, what, at least 15 years now, right?
Oh, sure. The Supreme Court just actually, was it last year, decided on a smartphone GPS case that was kind of a fishing expedition.
Yeah, and the Supreme Court actually seems to be issuing some very smart decisions about smart devices. So we can keep our fingers crossed that that trend continues. But the other thing you mentioned, that civil cases are, oh, but to finish my point, though, I'm sure that people wondered, you know, about all the data on devices before there were things like smart light bulbs and smart locks and smart watches and smart sleep apnea devices. So it's just throwing a whole lot more data into the ecosystem. And the way the legal system handles that, again, this is a question of principles that are hundreds of years old being applied to the conundrums that we're facing today. And those principles actually do a pretty good job of trying to make sure that we're having fair trials. Evidence has to be credible. It has to be legitimate and legitimized. So if you're going to introduce something in court, you have to be able to have an expert come in and say why the jury or the other trier of fact, if it's just a judge, can trust the conclusions that are being drawn from the data that's being put forth in court. So that's going to be true in a civil trial or a criminal trial. In order to trust this data, it's going to have to clear some hurdles of being evidentially credible and acceptable before it can do the job and convict or show somebody committed some illegal act.
So while I am concerned about being at the wrong place in the wrong time, I am less concerned about, you know, murderers getting caught up by their devices, right? That is less concerning. But when I think about civil trials, then I get really nervous about, like, who can subpoena my Fitbit data? Like, if there is, and that's just a random use case, I don't know why I would be in a lawsuit with someone about my Fitbit data. Like, what are the basic rules that we should be aware of? Like, how is that data accessed? Who has a say in saying yay or nay to it?
Right. So if you're a party to a lawsuit, a civil lawsuit, and that data is relevant to some dispute in the lawsuit, and that's something that might have to be fought out with the judge, whether it's relevant or not. But if you're a party and it's relevant, then if it's under your control, then you have to fork it over. Oftentimes with these Internet of Things devices, it might not be under your control. They may have to go to the third party data repository and subpoena it from there. And again, just as if that party had documents, just the fact that it's hard-coded data doesn't mean that they don't have to turn it over if there's a subpoena or a court order that says that they should, to help resolve this dispute. So a good question would be, what is the data retention policy going to be for these devices? How much of this stuff is going to live on for perpetuity? Is it going to be very ephemeral so that it can't be subpoenaed and used? That's going to vary company by company what they decide their policies are on that kind of thing. Obviously, the data is very lucrative, so they have some incentives to hold on to it. But at the same time, do they really want to be in the business of having to fork over data to fuel people's lawsuits and other disputes? Sometimes people come and knock on the door of a company and say, hey, you know, we'd like this information. They don't have a court order. They don't have a subpoena. I would hope that most companies' policies would be walk right away. We're not going to turn over people's data of any kind unless we're ordered to by due legal process. But you never know unless they're under various data protection regulations to decide how they're going to respond to those requests.
Got it. Well, and there's also an interesting wrinkle there in that there are lots of products out there on the market that have subscription plans for cloud storage of data.
Mm-hmm.
And the consumer, in some cases, may not, if they don't pay for that plan, have access to the data, but the company might still retain it, which
right.
I'm like, whoa, I don't even want to think about that.
Right. There's one other issue that your question raised, and that is I talked about if you're a party to the lawsuit and it's relevant and it's under your control, you have to turn it over. But we talked about one way in which third parties can be brought in if the data resides with a third party. But what if let's go back to your running by the murder scene with your Fitbit on example. What if the prosecutors there wanted to have the data from your Fitbit because you were a witness and they wanted to see how it impacted you? You know, they wanted to see if you saw anything amiss and if your heart rate spiked from your normal running heart rate because you saw some terrible event take place or not. Maybe the defense lawyers would want to say, hey, see, nothing happened. This witness ran by, their heart rate stayed dead the same. So you could see how you could be brought into a dispute or your device could, even if you have very little to do with it and just happen to be, as you said, in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yes, I'm going to hope I never run by a murder as it's happening for so many reasons. Right. All right. So we'll end on a very positive and cheery note. I'm going to ask you what you think the biggest legal issue facing the Internet of Things is today.
I think it's this fact that security researchers think that these devices in particular leak like a sieve. And again, analogizing back to the early days of other devices that are important in our lives, the early days of computers and operating systems, when those operating systems also, according to security researchers and demonstrably according to events that happened, leaked like a sieve. Ultimately, the operating system manufacturers got on top of that issue and got somewhat ahead of the cat and mouse game of people trying to compromise the device and patched devices and took care of the public using their tools. And I think that that's the problem that we see now. And we're with the Internet of Things sort of at that phase in development where it's still kind of wide open. Things aren't being patched, or maybe not only are they not being patched, they're being released in an insecure way to begin with. And even just without even being hacked, they're just something that leaks data and sends data around in ways that they shouldn't and that people don't expect and that is unreasonable. So that, I think, is the biggest problem that we're facing right now. And I think it will take a while and some growing pains and some lawsuits and some bad press, but that ultimately, hopefully, we will come to a point where the product being released in the first instance is as good a product as it can be at that time, and that it gets updated and patched going forward.
I will be hopeful with you.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's going to take a while and the economic incentives aren't quite there yet. So
yeah,
I can't wait. Well, Denise, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much, Stacey. This was a pleasure.
That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, if you'd like more IoT news, sign up for my newsletter at stacyonIoT.com. We'll see you next week.